you can't fall back on left versus right. And you have to go, wait a second, there are actually some really tough issues here about American foreign policy and America's role in the world.
In the midst of war talk about Syria, media critics give a rare thumbs up. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also, re-reporting of decades-old stories triggers memories and nostalgia.
Even if we didn't know each other 20 or 30 years ago, we have shared experiences through the news. We remember these stories. We remember them dominating the headlines.
Plus, the man who documented Washington's ongoing incest among media celebrities and pals was reporting from the inside.
One criticism has been that I violated an unwritten rule in which insiders should not speak critically of other insiders. I will plead totally guilty to that.
There's more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. When Daily Show host Jon Stewart returned from a 12-week sabbatical on Tuesday, it took him no time whatsoever to regain his sea legs.
After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets.
Wow! America taking military action against the Middle East regime. It's like I never left.
For Stewart, talk of red lines and airstrikes is an eerie reprise of the drumbeat for invading Iraq 10 years ago. And one big red flag he found, of course, on cable news, a rogues gallery of familiar faces supporting intervention. Neocons Paul Bremer, Donald Rumsfeld, and the hawkishly reliable William Kristol.
But I wish he could have intervened a year ago, 2 years ago.
Hey, everybody, the idiot parade is in town.
The message was pretty plain. Here we go again. Iraq Redux, duped into war hysteria by the same characters spouting the same pieties and telling the same lies. But is that the case? Putting aside that The Daily Show cut the videotape to misrepresent Rumsfeld's actual sentiments, was it also mischaracterizing the scope of the present debate? For instance, here was NBC's Brian Williams asking National Security Advisor Susan Rice about blowback from an attack on Syria.
What about the measurable chance, as recent history has taught us, that military action could, in this case, make things worse?
And here's Fox News' Bill O'Reilly asking Senator John McCain how sure he is that it was the Bashar al-Assad regime that deployed the poison gas.
There is a contention that it's a setup by the rebels who want Assad punished by the USA, want to get USA inside that country's activities. They did it. Assad didn't do it. That's the float contention that's around.
A decade after invented yellowcake uranium, innocent aluminum tubes, and phantom weapons of mass destruction, are we, as Stewart suggests, being marched blindly into catastrophe?
No, I think that that premise is totally wrong.
Max Fisher is a foreign affairs blogger for The Washington Post.
There have been people, and I'm not talking about me, people much smarter than myself who really care about the Middle East, care about Syrian foreign policy, have been writing reams about this for 2 years now. I think the coverage of Syria has been really nuanced, really careful, has really talked about the larger issues that are going on there. And I think it's a shame that some people walk in all of a sudden 6 or 7 days ago because now it's also a political issue and they hype up the political issue and that's all we're listening to. So, you know, I think Stewart is actually playing right into the hands of the very people that he's trying to criticize by making it all about them. And it's not about them.
A lot of the criticism of the press in the lead up to the Iraq War concerned how gullible the public was and the press with the Bush administration's string of allegations that Saddam Hussein was connected to the 9/11 hijackers, that he was purchasing yellow cake uranium from Niger, that he had aluminum tubes, which were the smoking gun of a nuclear program. Hook, line, and sinker. Tell me about the coverage that you've seen now and how it differs from a decade ago.
I think there's certainly a lot more looking critically at claims from the government. I mean, you're seeing the media really push back on even just the number of dead that Secretary of State John Kerry was citing. I think that Iraq is certainly top of mind for everyone. The mistake that we're repeating is that, you know, at first we weren't really talking about Iraq during the Iraq debate, which is one reason that it was so easy for us to make this mistake that Saddam Hussein would support al-Qaeda, which if you know even a little bit about al-Qaeda, Saddam Hussein is kind of on its face pretty silly. And I think that's a mistake that we're repeating a little bit in Syria, that we're not really talking about Syria right now. A lot of the debate that you see in these hearings with Kerry and Hagel and a lot of the media coverage that I've been seeing on it is talking about, is it American credibility at stake? What if the United States gets sucked in? Who's going to win the argument? Which party is going to look good? Often, I think it's to the exclusion of the actual Syrians in the actual Syrian war. And I think that that can really skew the conversation around it.
Notwithstanding the pyrotechnics around the congressional vote on cable, it seems to me that even cable news has done a reasonably good job at fleshing out the issues, the risks, the rewards, and so on. Am I hallucinating?
I think that they have been pretty good. I mean, the thing that people make a mistake about with foreign policy sometimes is they think, okay, just like any other issue, it's, you know, left and right. Right after Secretary of State John Kerry's speech last week, you know, basically laying out the case for strikes, CNN had a big debate on Syria policy between Van Jones and S.E. Cup. And it was just, you know, it was everything that was kind of wrong with the way that media covers foreign policy, because they don't know anything about it.
The usual pundit subjects parsing this all through the prism of domestic politics.
Right. Because what else could possibly matter than Democrats fighting with Republicans? But the thing about foreign policy is, A, it's really hard. And B, there are kind of these ideological divides on it that really don't fall on party lines. You know, the theorists would call it realism versus idealism. You know, you see in the Republican Party, there are a lot in the Tea Party wing led by Rand Paul who are saying, let's not get involved. Then you see people like John McCain saying, no, no, American leadership, we have to get involved. And you see something really similar on the left, where there are people who argue for humanitarian intervention. I'm thinking here of people like Anne-Marie Slaughter, who used to work for the State Department. And then there are the kind of anti-war left movement that said, you know, bombs are not the answer. And I think because you have that complication, it kind of disrupts the typical cable coverage of it, because you can't fall back on left versus right. And you have to go, wait a second, there are actually some really tough issues here about American foreign policy and America's role in the world.
Max, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Max Fisher is a foreign affairs blogger for The Washington Post. We started this conversation with The Daily Show, and funny thing about that, or actually, at least according to TLDR blogger PJ Vogt, something not funny about that. Vogt says that when it comes to Syria, both John Stewart and the satirical paper The Onion, always reliable at framing the news better than the news, have suddenly fallen flat.
I think that our nation's satirists are letting us down on Syria. I think that The Onion, who are super hawkish, are doing weirdly one-note bad humor on this. And I think John Stewart, who's incredibly dovish, is doing badly one-note anti-intervention pieces.
All right. Give me some Onion headlines to make your case.
So The Onion had, "Help has to be on the way now, thinks Syrian man currently being gassed. Obama deeply concerned after Syrian gassed to death on White House lawn. Syrians' lives are worthless, Obama tells daughters before kissing them goodnight." There's sort of a theme.
Okay, PJ. Now, comedy obviously is subjective, but you say these are objectively unfunny. Why?
Well, because they sort of rely on a much simpler version of reality than the one we're living in. I mean, all these Onion articles are premised on the idea that the case for intervention is very clear, that as soon as we get there, the slaughter will stop. I don't think even the people who are proposing intervention are saying that.
Okay, let's talk about The Daily Show. We played some tape from Jon Stewart's screed a little earlier. You've got another cut.
You can't use chemicals to kill your own people. You have to do it organically. America and the world want to make sure Assad only uses locally sourced free long-range lead ordnance. Now, back in the early 80s, we knew Iraq had used chemical weapons against Iran. We're likely to use them again, and not only did we not attack them, we supported Iraq in doing that. And of course, we still reserve the right to use bunker busters, cluster bombs, and the Mark 77, which is not filled with napalm, technically.
Okay, so with John Stewart, I think it's a little more complicated. He's against intervention, and so he makes this big case where he points out a lot of things that are true, that we're hypocritical, that we've actually – previous administrations have looked the other way on chemical weapons, that we use horrible weapons. But there is still this idea that maybe we don't want to live in a world where tyrants are allowed to gas their own people, and that maybe it's worth intervening for that reason. It's weird to elide that whole debate in the service of making – a stronger case.
So you're saying that comedy, especially political humor, has to obey the same rules of intellectual honesty that say we do?
Yeah, for my money, they do. And especially topical political humor. I mean, you can do it the cheap way. You can make jokes about the argument you wish the other side were making. But the reason that I think we cherish The Onion, the reason we cherish Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, is that typically they don't do that. And I wish they'd sort of get back to the standard I feel like I'm used to with Syria.
Okay. Now, I knew you were going to say all this stuff because I've read it on your blog, TLDR. PJ, pray, what is TLDR?
Too long, didn't read. It's what people post after incredibly long articles to either complain or to sort of like preface a summary.
All right. And you have expropriated that internet lingo for the blog, which does what?
Okay, so you know how the radio show that you host has a website?
Yes, onthemedia.org.
But we never post anything on it.
Well, there's that.
So we're posting things on the website now. We're posting really good blog posts every day, multiple times a day. It's text and audio and video. Alex Goldman, you know that guy?
Yeah, I know that guy.
He and I are putting out weekly audio, and we are hoping that listeners will visit it and let us know what they think and what they like and what they hate.
We are a multi-platform media, technology, and civil liberties clearinghouse. One-stop shopping.
You're damn right.
All right, PJ. Thanks again.
Thanks, Bob.
PJ Vogt is a producer for On the Media and a blogger for our very own TLDR. Coming up, is Washington a cesspool or an ongoing orgy of vanity and self-dealing? Yes, this is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. On the Media is supported by The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It will surprise you not at all to know that the seat of our national government, putting aside all the Greek columns and heroic statuary, is just a garish circus of vanity, posturing, lying, self-dealing, and professional incest. That the media and the political class have formed an unholy alliance is also not news. Enter, though, Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, who had the temerity, and the access to document the sordidness in all its delicious and repulsive detail. His best-selling book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital, is like a cell phone camera sneaked into an orgy. As in, OMG, is that Andrea Mitchell? Ew! Mark, welcome back to On the Media.
That's the single best introduction I have had since this book has come out. And I don't mean that just in the Suck Up City context.
You begin with the funeral of the late Meet the Press host Tim Russert. And what a tableau. Describe this scene.
I was struck in June of 2008 on this very solemn occasion when the person I call the mayor of official Washington, Tim Russert, dies. This pageant of a funeral that was held in his honor just became this cocktail party in which everyone was throwing business cards around, people were networking, and doing very, very well to make sure that they were placed diplomatically before the cameras so that they could mourn better than their peers. So, yes, this was my jumping off point, and it became a 5-year anthropology of the Washington political class, of which the media is a big part.
The universe you describe in this town has, in some ways, always existed. Vanity, hypocrisy, and corruption are not new to Washington, D.C. But if I understand your book right, they have been supercharged by, of all things, cable television.
Well, among other things. I mean, I think cable was probably one of the first revolutionary entities back in the, I guess, early 90s, back in the Clinton days. It sort of gave everyone a face. It sort of expanded the population of celebrity operatives and people who could just sort of dine out on their own telegenic brands. What is supercharged about this is that we are living in an era in Washington of incomparable wealth. This is now the wealthiest community in the United States. There is more money in politics, more money in just sort of the political class than there ever has been. New media has made easy second acts, easy fame, sort of cheap notoriety easier than ever, and also the celebrification of politics, all of which is sort of conjoined at a time when Barack Obama was coming to town, sort of creating his own celebrity ecosystem, and here we are.
Another tentpole in this town is the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That used to be a standalone affair where politicians and the people who covered them rubbed shoulders for one evening, leaving the press feeling slightly awkward but also slightly self-important. But the event you describe in this book has just metastasized into this preening excess.
A single banquet is no longer sufficient, Bob, to celebrate the full achievements of the political media. It now must take place over a 5-day period in which we have 24 or so pre-parties, after-parties, tens of millions of dollars spent on entertainment and food and all that fun stuff, and all kinds of press coverage spent on the press. I mean, it's journalists congratulating journalists about their journalism, right? So I think this is a classic metaphor for the media and also Washington in general's inability to control itself and knowing something is grotesque and horrific and a joke and yet just amping it up. And I mean, I think it's the perfect example of the bubble world this has become and frankly the decadence that has prevailed here.
The book is very gossipy. Lobbyist Ken Duberstein gets especially rough treatment. Lobbyist and ex-Senator Evan Bayh is one of many portrayed as a hypocrite, liar, and public servant of easy virtue. Terry McAuliffe, now running for governor of Virginia, just gets eviscerated. Your old Washington Post colleague Howie Kurtz, now of Fox News, comes off as just a total blowhard. NBC's Andrea Mitchell, whom you don't actually say anything nasty about, but who appears again and again in the book with her husband, Alan Greenspan, former Fed chairman, is portrayed as a socialite who the reader can only conclude cannot possibly conduct journalism at arm's length.
She is emblematic of a figure in Washington whose social life, whose professional life, whose personal life overlaps so seamlessly that you wonder where the boundaries are, where the barriers are. Now, I also must say, Bob, that because I work for the New York Times and because I'm a respectable journalist, I shy away from the term gossip. Everything, you know, whether about Evan Bayh or Terry McAuliffe, or I mean, this is all up to the standards of the New York Times. It's all.
Well, let's just go with character assassination.
Yeah, sure, yeah. That's fine.
There are two media figures in the book who play outsized roles in the ecosystem. One of them is a sort of internet age Walter Winchell, Politico blogger Mike Allen. Tell me about Mike.
Well, he works at Politico, which is this website that I do think has revolutionized the political and media conversation in this town. Mike writes Playbook, which is this morning email tip sheet that goes out to about 100,000 influencers, people in politics, people on the staff, people in media, bookers, and so forth. And basically Mikey's newsletter, and he is known as Mikey in this sort of somewhat infantilized, boyish, perpetual high school way of ours, that he has this outsized role in setting the daily agenda, in figuring out what the talk shows will talk about, what might be on tomorrow's front pages or on the evening news, and in a sense has a very internet age role that is maybe analogous to what the front page of the New York Times might have had about 20 years ago.
Another key figure in your book is somebody who I'm sure 99.9% of America has never heard of. Who is Tammy Haddad?
Tammy is a longtime producer for Larry King Live. She went on to work for Chris Matthews. And then she kind of reinvented herself to be this full-service convener of the new media Washington. Washington has always had, you know, party hostess, party convener types, people who get the A-list together. What's distinct about Tammy is that she has become a very, very successful businesswoman, and she has contracted her services out to a number of media organizations who pay her a good amount of money to do whatever it is she does, whether it's some video component, whether it's hosting events, whether it's putting people together. And one of the things she's been able to do for people is get them access to the White House. So I did profile Tammy both as a singular and sort of original character in the modern Washington, but also someone who very, very deftly has insinuated herself into an administration that said that they would absolutely reject all traditional forms of influence peddling, of access peddling, and that in a sense has been part of her her value proposition.
Now, the town you describe has reporters and pals constantly at the same parties exchanging not only air kisses but also favors and considerations, and generally conducting themselves not as adversaries but as members of the same club. And yet, Mark, and I know this is a question you prepared yourself to answer probably before you wrote the first word, you could not have written this book yourself if you were not one of them. You attend the parties, you extend some courtesies, you get book deals. So are you part of the solution or are you part of the problem?
I am absolutely an insider. I work for a major news organization. I would say that I am not invited to these parties because I am Mark Leibovich, charming, good-looking figure. I am invited because I work for the New York Times, and many people obviously think it's in their self-interest to be dealing with me or to have me in their rooms for whatever reason. I do have to be transparent about this, though. I mean, this is where I live. This is the life I've chosen to lead. I'm a political reporter. And yeah, maybe it did color my view a little bit, but I think it also gave me a kind of institutional knowledge that served me well. Ultimately, this book has been uncomfortable for me in many ways. I mean, it's made a lot of people uncomfortable. I think a lot of people are probably trashing me behind my back. One criticism has been that I violated an unwritten rule in which insiders should not speak critically of other insiders. I will plead totally guilty to that.
This town is a bestseller, which is a good thing because it does expose the vanity and the posturing and the lying and the self-dealing and the professional incest earlier referred to. Is there any chance in the world that anything you have written will have a material change at all on business as usual in our nation's capital?
This is a book that does not have the chapter at the end in which I lay out the 10 clean bullet points in which how we can make the capital work better and, you know, how I come out for campaign finance reform or a third party candidate or overhauling all the media or something. One of the things that frankly has disappointed me about this book is that I actually thought it would start a more animated conversation, even an argument inside of town, that there would actually be an occasion and someone would actually have their back up and someone would defend this way of life. And no one has. I mean, there's been this level of Yeah, he's right. Wow. Don't we feel dirty? And, like, when's the next party? I mean, to be honest with you, if this book gets me invited to fewer, you know, brunches or book parties, I think that's a positive unintended consequence.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is titled This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. And I guess I should mention, because, of course, I've known and lunched with Mark for 16 years. If you're a wannabe author and you want to be around writers, you could try a colony. Clusters of literati decamped to a remote location for both solitude and community, and the chance to exchange pages, ideas, and spouses. Or you could enroll in an MFA program and not only study at the knee of a tweed-jacketed mentor with an actual bibliography, but to workshop your manuscript with other students to solve problems or just stimulate ideas. Or you could just move to Brooklyn. Your next-door neighbor is probably a novelist, too. But for otherwise unconnected aspiring writers seeking criticism and support, there's a fourth way: virtual workshopping. A website from Penguin Publishing, Book Country, enables thousands of writers to exchange manuscripts and notes and self-publish their work. A few have even gotten traditional publishing deals through the site. Molly Barton is the global digital director for Penguin at Penguin Random House.
When I came to New York to work in book publishing, there was a festival at the time called New York is Book Country. So the website was based a lot on those early experiences trying to acquire fiction and nonfiction for trade and academic publishing houses and wanting to democratize the process and create a site where anywhere is book country. Your desk is book country. You don't need to move to Brooklyn. You don't need to go to a colony. You can just come and join the community online.
How many people have flocked to this virtual place?
We have around 10,000 users today, and it's a supportive community that encourages people to find writers who are working on books that are very similar to their own work. So people establish these collegial relationships, take their books through an average of 6 drafts on the site, and get feedback from more than 5 other members. People then can go on to publish on Book Country if they want to, or through a traditional publishing house.
What percentage of those who participate in Book Country have actually gone ahead and gotten novels published by third parties?
10 writers from Book Country have secured deals with traditional publishing houses. A couple of hundred are publishing through Book Country themselves.
What does it mean to be published by Book Country?
It's self-publishing, but in the context of a community. So, you know, there are two big challenges for every writer. How can you write a good book? And how can you get anyone to care about it? And our proposition is that participation in this community helps you solve both of those problems. You can revise to the point that you want the book to be good enough to be read by a wide audience. And those people who are your early readers are your first audience.
Now, in the good old days, or the bad old days, there was a mechanism in publishing for handling manuscripts which were just manifestly unworthy. And that was the curt rejection slip, which certainly sent the signal that whoever the author is should probably consider a different set of dreams because writing is not going to work out for them. Book Country has no equivalent of the rejection slip. How does the community handle submitted manuscripts that are just awful?
Well, there are two great things that happen. One is if a writer has written something that is just awful, not very many people will comment on it, or they will comment briefly and respectfully, but not say very much. There's a sort of graceful fadeaway. And the second thing that can happen is a manuscript that might seem terrible to one reader seems fantastic to another because they're the right audience for it. You can find subcategories and niche audiences that you wouldn't otherwise access.
What's in it for Penguin, or as it's now known, Penguin Random House, since the big merger?
It improves the quality of the work out there, and it also is a new model for the way that publishing could operate. So it's a bit of a strategic experiment.
Has any Book Country project really taken off Have you found the sweater girl sitting on the stool at Schwab's drugstore who has gone on to stardom?
It's too early days in terms of the books that we're publishing on Book Country to say, here's the winner. But we've got great work up on the site with a community of 10,000 writers, having 10 of them get deals with traditional publishing houses. That's a good indicator to me that the model we've put together generates successful books. And I'm optimistic that we will grow great talent on Book Country.
No Stephen King just yet.
Not just yet.
Molly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Molly Barton is the Global Digital Director at Penguin for Penguin Random House. Book Country began as a genre-specific publishing site, nurturing a community of romance, thriller, and sci-fi authors. Recently, Book Country expanded its purview to include more mainstream categories like young adult, literary fiction, and memoir. One active Book Countryman is Carl E. Reed, a fantasy writer who struggled with his novella for years before finding aid and comfort among unseen collaborators.
The Strange and Curious Tale of Professor R.H. Wilson is a novella written in the style of H.P. Lovecraft as if he were writing today. It's the story of a warlock set down in suburbia, a bit of a miserable misanthrope, and there are two young children next door who irritate him beyond distraction.
You have been working on this novella for how long?
I would say at least the last 5-6 years. If you go to any of the handful of periodicals which used to publish writers, they'll say closed the submissions, agented submissions, wanted only. So there really is nowhere to go with your fiction. So you have two choices. You can throw it in a box in the kitchen, which is what I used to do, or you could join Book Country and get out there and start workshopping and interacting with other writers.
You'd given up, hadn't you? You were just about ready to throw it all in.
Yep, absolutely. I had given up. I had quit. I said, that's it. Done. Finito.
Did the experience change your approach to writing? Are you a better writer now than you were 3 years ago?
Well, better, more consistent, more disciplined. Because there's somewhere to go with the work, and there's a vehicle for feedback, you know that somebody's going to be reading those words, and it makes the act of writing very real. It makes the process of calling yourself a writer, and I turned 50 this year, and writing for some 4 decades, it makes it something you can say without wincing. Yes, I'm a writer.
So, Carl, you're reborn.
In a way, yes, it's a very dramatic phrasing, but yeah, in a way, Bob, very much so.
Carl, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Carl E. Reed is the author of The Strange and Curious Tale of Professor R.H. Wilson, among other works. Available on Amazon.com and elsewhere. Coming up, an unholy collaboration from the 1930s, Hollywood and the Nazi regime. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Retro Report commences its second season. The short internet videos revisit big news stories from the past and re-report them, juxtaposing original archival footage with fresh interviews of the principals, a process that tends to alter or entirely dislodge age-old perceptions. Tegan Goddard is the publisher of the Retro Report. I asked him about an episode from the first season focusing on the bizarre and infuriating case of Tawana Brawley.
So you'll remember that there was a young woman up in upstate New York who accused police officers of brutalizing her, raping her, assaulting her in other ways. And to her defense came a group of lawyers. The most prominent one was the Reverend Al Sharpton.
It's all rushing back the memories of that case in which Sharpton and a couple of associates took this invented story and made all sorts of just unbelievable allegations against officials of New York State, against a dead state trooper.
Sharpton called Cuomo a racist, compared Abrams to Hitler, and said Raleigh would go to jail rather than cooperate with the investigators.
What Retro Report did is we actually went and interviewed the Reverend Al Sharpton and got him for the first time in years on the record about this story and about what he thought about this story and his role in it.
And of course, he was penitent and filled with shame, right?
Not exactly. I think he pretty much stuck to his guns.
I think a lot of the rhetoric, including mine, went too far. But I think that there's a difference between the rhetoric and the reason we got involved.
He says it's hard to judge something that happened so many years ago, but that's really what Retro Report tries to do, is to take a look at these stories and look at what happened years ago. And while we don't necessarily draw a conclusion either way, when this story came out, people on both sides of the issue took aim. Sharpton's supporters came out and used this reporting to try to make their case, as well as Sharpton's detractors. But at the end of the day, it is one of these stories over the course of the last 20, 30 years that really impacted the way Americans view race in this country.
There's a whole long list of similar stories in which our recollections of what happened back when don't necessarily jibe with our understanding of the issues today. There's Y2K. There's the so-called crack baby epidemic. Retro Report invites us to view these stories in a new light, but doesn't necessarily state its conclusions.
No, that's right. I mean, what we're trying to do is to bring the reporting up to date. In many cases, viewers are left with the wrong impression. So take the crack baby story. In the 1980s, you had government officials. You had Bill Bennett, the drug czar. You had Nancy Reagan, the first lady, talking about this crack baby epidemic in the cities.
Cocaine. Crack. If you use drugs while you're pregnant, your baby can die.
You had a scientist at the time who actually said that these babies would become a drain on the social infrastructure of our inner cities, that they would never grow to be normal functioning adults. Well, here we are in 2013. Look back at this. What happened to the crack babies? We haven't heard much about it. We interview the scientists who did this study, where many of these forecasts were based on. And he admits it was a faulty study. He admits that the shaking, the violent shaking that you saw on these videos on the evening news, was more due to the fact that these babies were born prematurely, because mothers who are using cocaine frequently give premature birth, than it was to the effects of crack or the effect that these babies were actually addicted to crack. And if you actually go forward and do the studies today, you find that pregnant women drinking alcohol put their fetuses at much higher risk than actually smoking crack. Crack really wasn't as bad as everybody made it out to be, but the video footage really was overwhelming and led us to a conclusion that really was not true.
All right, we've discussed the first season. The new one breaks this week. What old stuff is going to be new again?
We led off this season with a story about the Yellowstone fires back in the 1980s. You had a situation where for decades, federal policy was symbolized by Smokey Bear, who would try to encourage people to not use campfires and to not light matches in our national forests.
Only you can prevent forest fires. We heard that for about four decades.
And this was the message. But at the same time, you had federal policy which limited the number of intentional fires that may have been set, because fire is a natural process of the forests. It clears out some of the underbrush that kind of grows up. But with this federal policy, you had decade after decade of this underbrush growing and growing and growing, and it became a tinderbox. And in the 1980s, we had massive forest fires because of this. And so it's just an interesting look at a story in which people's perceptions about what caused forest fires and that forest fires were always bad under all circumstances wasn't necessarily true.
Your sponsor is the New York Times. I'm curious how the New York Times stands the test of retro reporting as you go ahead and put this series together.
The New York Times and all newspapers are seen as that first draft of history. But it is just a first draft. And so re-reporting these stories, looking back, learning new lessons from them is really an important part of really understanding the news. And so the New York Times instantly took to what we were doing and wanted to be our main distribution partner. So we're happy to have them. They provide a lot of knowledgeable viewers. And actually, we get some very interesting debates every Monday when we release one of these videos. What's fascinating about it is that long-form videos, 10 to 14-minute serious videos, actually can go viral. It's not just cat videos on YouTube that go viral. Retro reports have gone viral because even if we didn't know each other 20 or 30 years ago, we have shared experiences through the news. We remember these stories. We remember them dominating the headlines. And it's very exciting for people to talk about these things that they had of a shared experience. The nostalgia is a very powerful thing. And we all want to find out what happened.
Tegan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Tegan Goddard is the publisher of the Retro Report. You can find the latest episodes of Retro Report on the New York Times website or on retroreport.org. Looking back can not only yield fresh perspective on a familiar story, it can upend years of accumulated mythology about events. For example, if you think about Hollywood in the World War II era, most likely you'll think of its constant, often heavy-handed support of the war effort. Such films as The Great Dictator, To Be or Not to Be, Confessions of a Nazi Spy, and of course Casablanca were ruthlessly anti-German.
Play La Marseillaise. Played.
But as historian Ben Irwin reveals in his new book, The Collaboration, in the 1930s, both during and after Hitler's rise to power, Hollywood knowingly helped the Nazis. The major studios allowed the German government to censor their movies, not just in Germany, but worldwide, to eradicate any negativity about the Third Reich. Irwin says the unholy collaboration began after a riot sparked by the Nazis during the Berlin premiere of 1930s, All Quiet on the Western Front.
The movie was canceled that day, and then a few days later, the movie was banned in Germany, and a censorship meeting was held, and they suggested a series of cuts that should be made. 1 year later, Carl Laemmle, the head of Universal Pictures, came up with a new version of the film that contained none of the objectionable scenes. And the German censors said, "We will screen this film in Germany if you agree to make these cuts in all of the versions that will be screened around the world," which of course included the United States. And Carl Laemmle agreed to do this. And that decision really set the scene for the rest of the decade.
It wasn't an anti-German film. It was an anti-war film. What were Goebbels and the brown shirts agitating over?
From our perspective, All Quiet on the Western Front was an anti-war film. It appeared to just be showing the horrors of war. It appeared to be a pacifist film.
You still think it's beautiful and sweet to die for your country, don't you? Well, we used to think you knew. But first bombardment taught us better. It's dirty and painful to die for your country. When it comes to dying for your country, it's better not to die at all. There are millions out there dying for their countries. And what good is it?
From the German perspective, however, this is not what All Quiet on the Western Front was about. The Hollywood studios had been making movies from World War I, which showed German aggression and German defeat. In the First World War, one of the most notorious films was The Kaiser, the Beast of Berlin, which showed the German Kaiser committing all sorts of atrocities. The Nazis didn't believe that Germany had lost the war on the battlefield. The Nazis believed that the reason Germany had lost the war was because of propaganda that convinced German soldiers that they were losing. So this was a part, in their opinion, of a continuing propaganda effort against Germany.
There was a diplomat at the German consulate whose sole job was to go over scripts and look for anything that could portray Germany and Nazism in a bad light.
That's right. His name was George Gisling, and he got involved in about 20 different Hollywood productions. The ones at the beginning of the decade were the most important because those decisions really set the course for all of the 1930s. But he would meet with studio heads, and he would dictate cuts that should be made to films after he'd been given personal screenings. And reports would then be sent out to all of the German consulates and embassies around the world. And then those representatives would go out and watch the movies in their respective countries. And if there were any cuts that had not been made, that had been promised, measures would be taken against the Hollywood studios.
How could one country have been so important for Hollywood box office that the studios would so appease this nascent tyranny?
The Hollywood studios had been in Germany for decades, and they had these distribution offices in Berlin. They hired hundreds of people, and they felt that it was worth staying to preserve their investment. And as the decade progressed, it seemed more and more likely that Hitler would start a European war. And if Hitler started a war and he took over other foreign territories and they had left Germany, they might not be able to continue in those other territories as well.
Oh, dear God. So you're describing a hedge.
Right. And there are some very disturbing statements that I found when MGM, Paramount, and Fox were finally expelled from Germany in the middle of 1940, where they said things like, maybe in the future we'll be allowed to sell our movies in Germany again under new conditions outlined by the Nazis. And the implication of that, of course, is that Hitler would win the war.
What you describe is horrifying on the face of it. It is even more mind-boggling in view of the fact that the man you described earlier, the head of Universal, Carl Laemmle, Jewish, the heads of most of the major studios, Jewish, the creative ranks of all of the major studios, heavily Jewish. This was Jews appeasing Nazis. How?
My book really puts the various pieces of this story together. It's a complicated story. It's not one about a single Jewish voice of the studio heads doing business with the Nazis. It's about conflict within the Jewish community in Los Angeles at the time. It's also about individual screenwriters in Hollywood who were Jewish, who felt that what the studio heads were doing was a terrible, terrible mistake, and who tried to urge the studio heads to make movies about the Nazis. And the first screenwriter who proposed such a film was Herman Mankiewicz, who wrote Citizen Kane, and he drafted a script in 1933.
Mad Dog of Europe was the title of the script.
Yes. And George Gisling went around Hollywood and said that if this movie were made, then the studios would no longer be able to do business in Germany. And Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, declared, "We have a tremendous profit in Germany, and as far as I am concerned, this picture will never be made."
Now, eventually, in fulfillment of all of Goebbels' worst fears, when the United States entered the war, Hollywood was unleashed as a propaganda force against the Germans. When did the censorship end and the transition to anti-Nazi storylines take over?
Well, the myth up to this point has been that Warner Brothers, which made Confessions of a Nazi Spy in 1939, declared war on the Nazis, and that ended Hollywood's relationship with the Nazis.
I am a Nazi spy. I am one of thousands stationed in every part of the United States to steal the secrets of your national defense.
But this movie did not end Hollywood's relationship with the Nazis. MGM, Paramount, and Fox all continued doing business with Nazi Germany all the way up to the middle of 1940. The reason the arrangement with Nazi Germany ended was not because Warner Brothers made its film, but because Hitler started a war in Europe. And after September 1939, it became increasingly difficult for Hollywood to export movies in not just Germany, but also England and France, which were at that point much bigger export markets. And so 20th Century Fox begins its first anti-Nazi film, which was called Four Sons, and MGM begins its first anti-Nazi film, which is a much more significant film, The Mortal Storm. George Gisling issues protests, as you would expect, but the studios at this point don't listen, and they go ahead and make these films. And by the middle of 1940, MGM is kicked out of Germany, then 20th Century Fox is kicked out of Germany, and Paramount, which hadn't made an anti-Nazi film and had even pointed this out, was kicked out of Germany. And that was when the great storm of anti-Nazi films was unleashed.
Your book is about venality and greed and cynicism, moral compromise. But there's even evidence that the studios had real blood on their hands because of German laws that restricted the expatriation of Reichsmarks from Germany for Hollywood films screened there. The studios had to take their proceeds, well, and do what with them?
In 1933, the Germans passed a law that prevented all foreign businesses operating in Germany from withdrawing their Reichsmarks and turning them into foreign currency. What Paramount and 20th Century Fox did was they took the money from the proceeds from their films, they invested those Reichsmarks in German cameramen, and they bought German film stock, and they shot images of the nationalistic events in Germany, and they made these newsreels which were screened in Germany. The newsreels were essentially pro-Nazi in content. They then sent that footage back to Hollywood, and that footage was reshaped so that newsreels were made not pro-Nazi in tone, but neutral in tone, which showed what was happening in Germany. And those newsreels were then sold all around the world. And in this way, Paramount and 20th Century Fox recouped their profits through the sale of these newsreels. But MGM didn't make newsreels in Germany. And as the decade progressed, this studio was unable to export its money and was steadily accruing a German bank account full of Reichsmarks. And in December 1938, 1 month after Kristallnacht, MGM comes to an arrangement with the German government whereby it can export its money only if it invests in German firms that are producing German armaments. And that is how MGM exported its profits from December 1938 onwards, by investing in the production of German armaments.
Louis B. Mayer, Nazi war profiteer.
The document that I found does not mention Louis B. Mayer specifically, but it leaves no doubt that that was how MGM was exporting its profits.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Irwin, a member of the Society of Fellows at Harvard, is the author of The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler.
And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you, on that you can rely. No matter what the future brings as time goes by.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian, and the show was edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ian Turner. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone is attending her daughter's wedding. Congratulations, Max. She'll be back in a couple of weeks. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.